Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back talking Angrynomics. Speaking of anger, Martin, how are you?
Hello, Tony Groves. My name is Martin McMahon.
I love that. This is because we got him out of bed before Liveline starts. He generally doesn't get up till 1 o'clock. Oh, folks.
Give a dog a bad name, and you mean I am up early? You know, 3 out of 4 mornings.
Wait, listen, enough anyway. Long-time listeners of the pod will remember this time last year where we spoke with Eric Lonergan, who was one of the co-authors of the book Angrynomics. Eric is, you know, he's a macro hedge fund manager, but we won't say much. He's an economist and writer, and he's also one of the soundest men around. So, Eric, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us again.
Thanks, Tony. It's an absolute pleasure. Great to see you both.
The genesis of this, coming back to you, was, I think we mentioned previously, that we spoke only last week to Stephen Kinsler, the economist in University of Limerick, and he wrote a very long and interesting piece for the currency. And he mentioned in it, you know, the your book, in effect, and the theory of Angrynomics, and how this there's so much you can almost predictability of what both sides and how the polarizations are. But I want to go back to the actual last conversation that we had, because when we spoke about it, Angrynomics isn't just about, you know, the idea of tribe, the idea of righteous anger, and then I want to say it, you know, destructive anger. It was also about some of the solutions, and some of the solutions that you put forward, whether they're in the same guise or not. How would you feel now as we emerge from the pandemic? They've been adopted in different ways by different countries, Eric.
I mean, I think we've gone further than I would have expected. So in many ways, I'm thrilled about a lot of what I see happening in economics. Mainly, I have to say, in America. So I think, to a greater or lesser extent, if you go back, the three main things that Mark and I were coming up with as kind of how to turn Angrynomics into something positive was really along three lines. One was that we have to do something about limiting the effects of recession on the weakest in society. The next thing was to give assets or own ownership of assets to people who don't have any assets, because it'll improve their lives. And then the third thing was really about saving the planet and making the planet more hospitable for future generations. Now, if I take those one by one, in terms of, I'd say that in most of the developed world, the policies that were put in place to protect people from the recession around the pandemic, in the context of history, none of them were perfect. In many cases, they could have gone further. But in the context of history, it's a pretty amazing example of state intervention successfully to protect people's livelihood and the disruption to people's lives. And if you look what the Americans have turned it into, and this is what, you know, the irony of history is, we are actually reaping the benefits now of Trump. The left has reacted against them, and they realize the center isn't good enough. And that was one of the key themes in our book, is that, you know, politics has to matter to people. But if you want people to vote in a positive way, you have to give them policies that are actually going to change their lives in a constructive way. Otherwise, we're all going to be tribalists, because that's the kind of default motivator. But if you want to have a constructive politics, you've got to have real economics in it, things that will actually change people's lives in a tangible way. And I've got to say, I think Biden and Janet Yellen, very important, the Treasury Secretary under Biden, and she, I think, is the brains behind a lot of this. I think it's the most radical set of policies for maybe 20 or 30 years in the developed world. And it is going to make a tangible difference to a lot of people's lives in America.
Just going to stop the podcast there, and it's the old deal. Show us the money. We're putting out this work. We need to be able to fund it, to get it out there. Now, the only way we're going to do that is with patrons. If you're listening and you have a few bob, you kind of owe it to pay back, don't you? So become a patron. Patreon.com/tortoiseshell. That's just it, really, Tony, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's quite simple. But I will say, and I know this sounds really funny, you get a lot for your money. For your couple of quid, you get a consolidated feed. So all of the podcasts on the platform come to you in one feed, wherever your player is. You won't miss one. You'll be able to get all your favorite pods in one place. And you get actual invitations to the live online pods that we do, our Sunday show. We're coming up on our 45th live Sunday show, Martin. And the guests we've had have been extraordinary. The audience is always so engaging, so active. So look, if you enjoy what we do, help us keep going. It's that simple. We are truly independent. Like there's no ads, there's no sponsors, there's nobody in the background, there's no sugar daddy. You know, we need people to put their hands in their pocket to keep this platform running, because it is a platform. It's become a hub for so many other stories that wouldn't necessarily get out there. And you can help us keep going. Patreon.com/TortoiseShack. We'll let you go back to your podcast now. Thank you.
I think it's the most radical set of policies for maybe 20 or 30 years in the developed world. And it is going to make a tangible difference to a lot of people's lives in America. And for me, that's ultimately what we were asking for in Angrynomics. Now, outside of America, I see a lot less of this. And there's a lot more I think we should be looking at and trying to do. But on that front, I think it's pretty amazing what they're doing.
I think that's very fair, because I think we've all been taken aback by how much more radical Joe Biden has been, considering, you know, his long time in politics and his ability to be this guy who kind of tries to appeal to all sides and looks for bipartisan agreement. But, you know, he has been, his stimulus package, his moves in terms of and trying to improve the lives of people. If I could bring that back for a moment to... Yeah. For example, to, you know, some of the things that we've seen in the Green New Deal for Europe, for example, and the COVID recovery plan, that kind of started, like, really, it looked fabulous in much of the headline numbers, and it did quickly get watered down where certain things were, you know, budgets were cut, particularly actually around some of the green initiatives. You must have been disappointed in that, because when you think we were supposed to rally in the face of a global pandemic, if we can't get it right in the face of a global pandemic, what can we do for the next crisis that's coming?
Tony, I totally agree. And I'm very worried about Europe. You know, the fiscal stimulus. So when people start talking about a regime change, modern monetary theory, how macroeconomics has changed, they're talking about America. But that's the truth. If you look, Europe's fiscal stimulus is about a tenth the size of America's relative to GDP. Right. So it doesn't really register. And the reality is, you know, I spend a lot more time than I should do listening to economists in Northern Europe, right? Because it's very easy. You get Americans coming over, you get a French economist or a British economist saying, oh yeah, the fiscal rules in Europe need to be changed. That's not the impression I get speaking to the Northern Europeans, right? The fiscal rules have been temporarily suspended, right? And in the next 18 months to 2 years, according to the Commission, once GDP gets back to where it was, the fiscal rules are back on. And I'm hoping there's flexibility, but we don't need flexibility. They need to be torn up.
Yeah.
And I've presented in Germany on this, if you look at where interest rates are. So I'm afraid problems on the horizon, because the mindset shift hasn't happened in Europe. And that deeply concerns me. Because effectively what the Americans are saying, or at least I would actually call them the center left, you know, Janet Yellen is about as far away from a Marxist, you know, I mean, I have a huge amount of respect for her, but, and what she's doing is fantastic, but it's all based on evidence. It's rigorous. It's thorough. It's ambitious. And what they're doing is but they have to win, though, you know, because if that is a viable political strategy, you need to get a political reward from it. They're changing people's lives constructively. But who's doing that in Europe?
Yeah.
Where's the parallel? I can't see any.
Yeah, no, I think you raise a really interesting point, because, you know, we look in terms of the stimulus and what's been done in Europe, and then we still keep hearing the bill will have to be paid. You know, some of the actual language that we heard in the austerity measures that were taken and how that was in, and that rhetoric has come back to the fore. And as you say, they're talking about a return to the debt to GDP ratios and these things. I mean, surely that is like the old phrase of cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Absolutely.
If we do that, not just in terms of say somewhere like Ireland, but in terms of somewhere like Spain, Portugal, Italy, some of these countries that have suffered great grief over the terms of a pandemic, to ask them then to accept that we're going to go back to this, that cuts are the way forward, Eric, would lead to the sort of stuff that you speak about in the book. A deeper tribalization and more polarization.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I don't know if I told you, Tony, but my mother, I was born and brought up in Dublin. My father was Irish, but my mother's Italian. And so I kind of have a split personality in that way. And I'm glad to say this, you can get a great pizza now in Dublin. It has to be said, you don't have to go to Italy. But anyway, as an aside, But I do worry a lot about places like Italy because, I think Ireland, I've only been, as I said to you, I'm over here at the moment. I've only been here the week. And, it wouldn't be surprised to me if Ireland's really booming, 12, 18 months time now the vaccine's getting rolled out, that there's a really great recovery. But the probability of that happening in Italy is very, very low. You know, if you look at the demographics, you look at the challenges the structure of the economy has, I was looking at comparing the cost of borrowing to the government with nominal GDP growth now, which is the right way to think about whether the government can borrow or not. And Italy has barely grown in nominal terms for a decade. So even with interest rates at these low levels, it's got some real challenges. But, I would go back to the point which we discussed the last time. You think the Irish government can borrow at negative real interest rates for 20 years fixed, right? So people say, what if interest rates go up? No, that's a fixed rate of interest, right? Imagine you could get a mortgage for 20 years at 1%. Now, all you need is a buy-to-let with a 4% rental yield, and you're making money.
Which is why we have
guaranteed upward only rents.
We have a queue of investors saying we would like some of those Irish. What is it? It's the enhanced leasing 25-year lease, which guarantees you 4% per annum.
There you go.
Money for old rope.
Right. So why doesn't the government? So this is the thing that's crazy about the fiscal rules. Is it's fair enough to say we're not going to spend it on current expenditure? But you cannot defend not spending it on capital expenditure.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right, you should be building roads, schools, hospitals. You cannot defend it. Education, housing, it's indefensible.
What do you think the difference between the EU and the US is? Do you think it's the EU is more bureaucratic, slower to move, or that it just can't see outside that very strict neoliberal box?
I think it's two things. I am a big believer in the power of ideas. And your history, because economics isn't a science, well, even when it is proven empirically, people will deny it. They refuse to believe it, right? And so they're informed by their history. So, I mean, as you know, the Northern Europeans, the Germans in particular, very, very biased by the history of hyperinflation. They see inflation around every corner. The Europeans more recently, and this would explain, I think, in part, places like Ireland to some extent, terrified because of the euro crisis. You see, we forget this as well. I mean, the euro crisis was a massive fuck up by the European Central Bank. Right, under Trichet, they didn't do QE, so they caused a panic in the sovereign bond market. And then, of course, Draghi, 3 years later, all he had to do was say, whatever it takes, I'm going to do QE. The whole thing went away. But that trauma, and we forget, that only happened in Europe, you see. Nowhere else.
Can I come in on that, Eric, just on
yeah.
Because when you made the point about the US being so far ahead of the European mentality currently, there was a 3-year lag I mean, the U.S. turned on QE almost quantitative easing almost immediately as soon as they could. They pumped the money in, and they saw the return. And we were still in the mindset of, you know, no, we as if we were balancing as if the EU was going to do a household budget. You could only spend what you make, and we until we woke up. And as you said, what the game changer was when they used the phrase "whatever it takes to save."
That's right,
the euro, and that changed everything.
Yeah.
Are we still in that? Are we going to be 3 years behind the US again?
Well, I worry that, you see, there's a truth to it because, you know, the reality is Ireland can't print money in the same way that America can print money. It's the European Central Bank that prints the money. And this is where you get a problem with the Northern Europeans, because they still have a mindset that somebody's cheating on them. You know, the truth of the matter is if you behind closed doors, you speak to German politicians or Dutch politicians and you talk about economics and fiscal policy, their sole objective in Europe is to rein in Southern Europe. You know, they just think we save, they borrow. They're free riding. If they want to have lower interest rates, they've got to save more. And to be honest, you're never going to break. I mean, I don't know what it
the fact the facts don't even break bear that out. Like, no, I mean, I think it was in the first tranche of the large loans given to Greece, for example. And I'm just going to use numbers off the top of my head. So again, if you want to correct me later, listeners, go ahead. But let's just imagine it was 100 billion. It's pretty clear that of that 100 billion, the first 68 billion of it went to French and German banks. You know, it literally was a revolving door into Greece, out to the other end, and settled up with the and filled the balance sheets of French and German banks. And if we were to acknowledge that, we might have to acknowledge that, you know, buyer beware as well. And you know, you can't just say feta cheese and feckless Greeks.
Oh, look, it's total hypocrisy and it's innumeracy, you know, because again, the idea that everybody can save, it's mathematically impossible, you know. So if the government runs a surplus, i.e. the government is taking in more income than it's spending, by definition, somebody else is running a deficit, right? Because if they're taxing us more than they're giving us, that means, you know, we must be making up the shortfall. So now the way the German private sector and public sector both run a surplus, but that's of course because they have a huge trade balance with the rest of the world. They require to run it now. But again, you know, the world can't run a trade surplus. So it just doesn't work. It's economic illiteracy. The problem with economics, and this is still a curse with it, is it's laden with moral overtones. So it's like the saver is good, the borrower is bad. When often, if that doesn't, that's just meaningless nonsense, to be honest, because you couldn't have one without the other. But these value judgments are still there. And so we've got a challenge in Europe. And then, you know, but the bit I always try to explain to Northern European economists, then I say, then you can't complain that you've got negative interest rates, because, you know, why are interest rates now going to start going up in America? It's because there's a big fiscal stimulus. You know, if everybody's trying to save, everybody's cautious, all that'll happen is you're going to get incredibly low interest rates, and they stay very low.
Why is there such an obsession with low interest rates? I mean, low interest rates are not necessarily bad for the individual.
Yeah.
So why is there such an obsession?
I think the Germans in particular, there's also a mindset of living off interest income and saving with bank deposits. And so I think, and this is where, you know, you guys know, I'm a proponent of the European Central Bank effectively doing zero interest rate perpetual loans to all citizens of the EU, which is effectively an accounting trick to make a cash transfer. And my view is then they can't complain because everybody's getting a cash, you know, do it for everyone.
This is the helicopter money principle that we spoke about previously.
That's right. That's right. No, and in effect, that's what America has done. They just did it through the government sending you the check and the Fed buying the bonds. So it's just, they printed money and they transferred it. Mm. The problem in Europe is that's illegal. because you can't, the central bank isn't allowed to effectively transfer the cash to the government and get the government to spend it. They're not like, you've got to go direct. But the problem, but you know, so you need to get radical, and this is the problem.
Can I come in on that? Because I remember listening to as the euro was falling apart, and we were looking at, you know, and the things that you talk about in your book, that polarization, the north versus south, the mentality, the ideas, the differences, the stereotypes that crept in, and the nationalism that crept into it. One of the things that was actually suggested, and it was by the failed finance minister in Greece, Yanis Varoufakis, was, it was similar to what you've said, but how he said it, what would be a real powerful moment is if the check came from the EU and it was signed by the head of, let's say it was von der Leyen now, and it was signed by von der Leyen, the amount of people who would suddenly feel more European overnight.
Oh my God. I absolutely.
Can I go back to where you were saying about radical? We've seen, particularly here in this country, where radical centrism has become the go-to solution or the go-to place.
It's become a phrase. It's saying, I'm going to say I'm a radical centrist, but in the next line, I'm going to say the bill needs to be paid, and I'm going to work.
And so, I was just going to ask, do you think the solution can come out of radical centrism?
Well, I'm not a fan of any of those terms, which won't surprise you. I like the word radical for sure. But I don't care. Like, I find this really curious when people go, I've got to, you know, it's got to be in the center. It's like, why are you attached to the center? You know, I really don't care. I'm interested in good ideas that make a difference. And I don't care where they come from, left, right, or center. It's a curious psychological trait, isn't it? That people want to be, I guess it kind of signals reasonableness by definition, but I don't care. But I want to go back on what Tony said. I think this is really important. And I think Europe desperately needs this, is something that a citizen, and I think it's interesting when you think about politics like this, where you can literally go, I'm benefiting from this because I'm in the European Union or I'm in the euro. That is really important psychologically, because unfortunately, and this I've observed with the Italian side of my family, and when I go to Italy, the change in Italy, the anti-Europeanism, is really profound, because they used to believe Europe is good for us. And in the last 20 years, they've started to think, no, it's bad for us. And I desperately think they do need that check with somebody's signature that says, this is because you're a European.
But it's easy for them to make the assumption that Europe over the last 20 years hasn't been acting in their best interests.
Yeah.
I mean, the EU has changed. I mean, if anything, it has moved, certainly fiscally, to the right. And it has moved to the right. And it serves big business, but it doesn't serve the individual. I mean, we have the issues, same issues as in Italy, is in homelessness. The idea that you'll ever own your own home is becoming a daydream or a dream for younger generations. Plus, the younger generation is now going to be poorer than their parents. So, I mean, the proof is in the pudding. Centrism, radical centrism, neoliberalism hasn't worked to deliver. And it just simply hasn't.
That's right.
So where do
and
we
you've
go?
Got the snake oil salesman are still thriving, you know, and this again, when you look in Italy, if you look at Salvini, you know, the five star, the Northern League, this stuff hasn't gone away.
Yeah, economics and politics, and I suppose that's where Angrynomics comes in.
Well, can I come in on it, Martin, though? Because we're going to talk a bit. We can talk about it over the decades and say how, you know, the argument was that capitalism lifted more people out of poverty than any other model in the history of the world. We can acknowledge this. We can also acknowledge that in the last couple of decades, neoliberal capitalism has created wealth inequality, and we've seen great transfers of wealth from the bottom to the top, and we've seen it in the midst of a global pandemic. One of the solutions you keep talking about, Eric, and I think it's really important that listeners get this, is actually making sure the money goes to the individual and not to the people at the top. So the idea of something like a sovereign wealth fund was something that you spoke about.
That's right.
Can you give us just a flavor of who how that can be done with in the modern way of managing money and finance.
Okay.
And if that's okay with you.
No, definitely. I'd love to. And it's really important. And we didn't talk about it. Now, you just described to me how that these private investors want to get these fixed rent or upward rent revision assets in Ireland, right? Now, I don't know what rates they're borrowing at. They're probably using leverage to try and increase their returns, right? The point of it is that the Irish government can borrow cheaper than any investor, any private sector investor in the world. So my point is, why doesn't the Irish government go, I'm going to set up a sovereign wealth fund, but I'm going to issue 20-year fixed rate bonds to finance the acquisition of the assets. And I'm going to do, 20-30% of GDP. It's going to be in a separate account. And it doesn't increase the net debt because you have assets. So you increase your debt, but you're also going to buy assets. So your net debt is going to be unchanged, right? It's a bit like buying a house with a mortgage. Right. And then what you do is you say, okay, I'm going to hold out to tender BlackRock, all of these big global asset managers. And I want them to generate us a 4-5% real return across diversified assets, just like the Harvard Endowment or the Wellcome Trust or the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, which has delivered returns around those levels over 20 years. And there's going to be some years it'll fall, some years it'll go up by more than that. But on average, it's going to deliver me something like a 4% real return. Now, I'm saying do that right now, straight away. Bond market's open, and you can ask an asset manager to do that. Now, the power of compound interest is in 15 years' time, you can repay the debt, and you've still got the assets. You've created value of 20 or 30% of GDP. Now, all I'm saying is you've just bought those assets on behalf of the Irish population. Then you distribute ownership. So the people in your society who don't have any assets, just 60, 70% of the population, give them a share in the sovereign wealth fund, which they could then use for housing, for healthcare, for education, start up a business, buy a home. That's the plan. So all I'm really saying is, given the cost of debt is so low to governments, that they're actually, all I'm saying is, why don't you do what an asset manager is doing on behalf of the 1%? Why don't you just do that for your population? If the Norwegians can do it, why can't we do it? The interesting thing about Norway, people say, oh, but the Norwegians had oil. Over 50% of the value of the sovereign wealth fund in Norway is now returns. It's not oil. They generated a return. And so, that's absolutely doable. Because in a sense, I mean, inequality is a massive issue. But I also just think, give people a share, give people a stake, make a difference to their lives. And that could be done. That could literally be done within 12, 18 months. And you could even distribute ownership. It may be, you have to say, it's like any savings. You can't draw this down now. You're going to have to wait 10 or 15 years until we've repaid some of the debt. But you could give people a stake straight away.
Yeah, I think, again, it's so funny how with people like to overcomplicate some of these matters, but they can be quite simple if you, yeah. But the logic like that is going to be seen as radical. And it's funny because we will, you might point at the asset managers and we'll go, well, some of the problems we have is with some of these asset managers, but why not have them working on behalf as opposed to against? So there's always that pushback there. I suppose last thing, Eric, is really, you've been going around now, like we've spoken mostly with the EU and Europe. What are you thinking in terms of, say, for example, in the news this week in terms of the G7 and the moves on, for example, a minimum corporation tax taken and that? Have you got any thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm pleased because I think there needs to be international cooperation on a lot of economic issues. And it doesn't make sense to have corporations free riding and trying to play different one country off the other and not paying their fair share of taxes. I also think it's very interesting what's been happening in markets. My day job is there is a huge cultural change in terms of environmental social governance happening across the private sector, the likes I've never seen before. I mean, I think it's very similar to the rise of shareholder capitalism coming out of America in the 1980s. There is change is definitely afoot in the private sector. Now, there's going to be lots of problems. It's not simple. But it's pretty amazing what's happening. And I think consumers are going to change as well. So I think it's going to become a problem for brand. I think companies are going to start getting targeted now if they're not paying their fair share of taxes as well.
Ethical shareholders.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you'd said that to me 5-10 years ago, I'd have gone, but I'll tell you, it's happening. And their share prices are getting hit. That's why they care about it.
Yeah.
You know, there's no better way.
Though. I think it was inevitable. In a changing world, it's inevitable.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants to buy from BP if they don't have to.
Yeah,
we can talk about the, like, actually what you might be seeing is corporate social responsibility might actually mean corporate social responsibility and not a banner in the back of the office that mentions our shared values. But maybe I'm still pretty cynical, Eric. So I await.
You should be. And there are problems. Don't get me wrong. But I'll tell you what, big listed companies are changing. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. It's been hilarious, our household, during lockdown, because my partner advises, you know, real businesses, as it were, rather than me in markets. And I'd say like 8 out of 10 of her meetings is with companies. She's an expert in sustainability, but these companies, the clothing industry, the fashion industry, all of these companies, there's just been a huge sea change in mentality. And I'm observing, because you can actually measure it in what I do, is, you know, if you look at the price of a green bond versus a non-green bond, it's costing you. So the thing is, so the cynic, you should be cynical, but the thing is, if you're a cynic, you go, they care about their share price, they care about their cost of debt. It's affecting their share price now. It's affecting their cost of debt. And if they own the shares and their shareholders are putting pressure on them, so it's interesting. Now, there are going to be problems, and you know, we could probably have another whole chat about it, but it's happening. It's interesting.
Eric, I think that's an optimistic note to leave it on. So thank you very much for joining us this morning, Eric Lonergan.
It's a pleasure, Martin.
And it is lovely to have a chat, and we hope we have to talk to you again later on. Thanks, Eric.
I'd love to do that. Cheers, Martin. Cheers, Tony.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening, folks. We're back this evening. We have Seamus McElwain from the Progressive Unionist Party to talk to us about how things have changed in the North, and maybe some things that he would like to see changed. So keep an eye on the feeds. We really appreciate the support. Let people know, and we will talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.